Okay, what do you think of this theory? Does it sound reasonable? Do you see problems with it? What do you think? Do you see this as something you could accept, you could agree with? Do you have questions about it?
Just why these other scholars from the previous, you know, why couldn't they see that, that the mark was the first?
Why the earlier scholars didn't recognize Mark as the first? Well, for some of them, it was because since Augustine, there had been this assumption that the order in the Bible is also the chronological order of writing. And so that kind of just continued. And to my knowledge, the specific phenomena, the question about the similarity, for most of church history, this was not raised. They didn't really care. Did they notice that they were word for word similar? Of course they did. Anybody who reads them enough will notice that. They just didn't think that was a sufficiently interesting puzzle to worry about. It kind of reminds me of the very first time I taught this class, long, long time ago. I was preparing to teach this class, and I was at I was invited to a conference, actually in Latvia, about understanding of the Bible, how we read the Bible, how we understand the Bible. And they had one of the guest speakers that came in, they invited an Orthodox priest. And so he talked about the Orthodox approach to the Bible. And then there was a question time. And so I asked him about some of these theories, like source criticism and some of these theories. And I said, asked him, how do Orthodox scholars react to these theories that developed in the West? And he looked at me. He was very educated. He knew exactly what I was talking about. He just looked at me and said, I asked, how do you react to them? He said, we don't. We don't. We don't care. Now, if you would ask him, he was very educated. If you'd ask him about, well, then how do you explain the word for word similarity between Matthew, Mark, and Luke? His answer would be, we don't care. Like, we don't care about the questions of origin. The question, where did it come from? For the Orthodox Church, that's not a priority. I mean, for a real, sincere Orthodox priest, the question is the spiritual meaning. That's what matters. And so for most of church history, that was the same for all Catholic, Lutheran, Protestant. The primary focus has always been the spiritual teaching of these texts. And so they recognized the word-for-word similarity, but didn't really bother about asking why. It's more with the Enlightenment. Well, it is exactly with the Enlightenment and the emphasis on rational understanding, scientific thinking. That's when questions like why or how did they come into existence? That's when these questions became relevant or serious. So, yeah. Any other questions, comments? Are you talking in general or this specific example?
Both.
Okay. So the question was, do I think these are important questions that we should deal with? Yes and no. What I would say is, if we lived in a culture that was if we lived in a culture where these kind of questions did not matter at all, then I would say no. Then I would not bring it up. I wouldn't worry about it. I'd just look at the spiritual message of the text. And I think we'd be able to get 99% of what we need out of that spiritually. There are some little things, and we're going to get to that in a minute, where this can give a good spiritual insight that can help us when we read the text. But 99%, not really necessary. But the fact is, we live in a world that is very rational, very much influenced by the Enlightenment thinking, scientific inquiry of how and why and all of that. And so whether you like the theories or not, this is like what I've said from the beginning, whether you like the theories or not, you still come across them. You still meet people. And I gave the example from, I mean, this is 15 years ago, when one of our former students encountered these theories on the tundra in Siberia, in a small little village you could only access by boat or helicopter, no roads, and people had heard of these theories. And she was there on a mission team, and the guy's asking her questions about the Bible. And she came back and said, you know, thank you for the course, because now I understand why it was needed. So we are in a position where we have a responsibility to understand what's going on so that we can give a rational explanation, have a rational discussion, answer the questions, and not answer the questions because the person on the tundra in Siberia needs to know the order in which the gospels were written, but because you need to continue this conversation to point him towards Jesus. And if you give him the impression that you have no clue what he's talking about, he might very well come to the conclusion, okay, you're not a very educated person here. You're not very intelligent. If you can't answer my questions, he might just walk away. We need to be able to intelligently interact to show that we know what you're talking about and explain what's going on. I mean, that builds trust and connection, that then you can lead him to what's important. Because obviously, the question of the historical process of how the books were written is far less important than the theological message of the books. As Christians, that should be obvious. So in an ideal world, maybe I wouldn't bother with these. I don't think in that sense it's necessary, but we live in the world in which we do. So any other questions, comments? Okay.
Ma mäletan, et ma olen mingisugustes ainetes, mille ma rääkin ka sellest, et mis oli esimeses sajandil või oli ka teine sajand. Mõned kiriku isad, mingisugused tegelased kirjutasid, et Matteuse evangeelium on esimene evangeelium. Kuidas siis nagu sellesse suhtud? Kas nad siis nagu valetasid või nendel oli vale info või...
Okay, so you said somewhere in the second century, an early church father wrote that Matthew was the first. Well, I told you Augustine did, but he's 5th century. Papias is the first one who mentions anything about the writing of the Gospels, and that's in 115. So that's the beginning of the 2nd century. There's definitely nobody from the 1st century. Who says anything about the order of the Gospels. Is there someone, I mean, there are others, Irenaeus says a little bit, don't remember the details, but I'm not sure if, I'm not aware of anybody before Augustine who says that Matthew was first. But I could be wrong. I'm not an expert on early church fathers. It's always difficult, even in the second century, you're dealing with 100 years later, a century later, and direct information, direct knowledge gradually fades out. I mean, the middle of the second century, you still have a few individuals who remember the Apostle John, the last of the disciples, but they are, I mean, you're gradually fading from the eyewitness or the people who knew the eyewitnesses, the eyewitnesses of the apostles, and you're gradually fading out of that. And as the Christian faith also spreads, you're getting more and more spread out from the original. We can't take everything that the early church said in the first 200-300 years as absolutely true, because they're people. They were not inspired by God. So we have to listen to their testimony, but we also have to think analytically, critically about it. I do, as I said, I do think there's a better argument to say that Mark was written first. Augustine in the 5th century, I mean, that's 400 years after Jesus. Augustine did not have direct first century, direct connection with any of the apostles. I mean, it's 400 years. So, yeah. It depends who said it, when they said it, what was their connection to the apostles, how close were they. All of that has to be considered. Irina, you wanted to ask something. Now I will walk over here so you can use the mic and the camera will follow me. Okay.
Я, может быть, пропустила, может, вы говорили об этом. Что источнику это был один автор или это было какое-то собрание на 50-й год?
Q is generally thought, generally referred to as if it's one source. But it most likely one source, most likely one written source. But again, this is something that different scholars will argue about, and they'll give some reasons saying, well, you know, there's of those 235 verses, some of them have a little bit different focus and kind of are try to divide them into different, I mean, source criticism. They can try to do that with Q. And then you can write your PhD dissertation and do something unique. So they will come up with all sorts of theories, but it is largely theoretical. Well, it's purely theoretical because there is no, I mean, maybe someday archaeologists will find a written manuscript from the 1st century that only has those 235 verses. And oh, we found it. But so far, there's nothing. If it existed as a physical manuscript, it disappeared quite early. And maybe after Matthew and Luke appeared, maybe it sort of lost popularity. There was no need for that because we've got these. And so people stopped copying and using Q. We don't know. We don't know. But yeah, Q is, it is simply a convenient way of explaining those 235 verses that way back here. For example, I think this passage was from Q. That's almost word for word identical in Matthew and Luke. And then here, where I showed again, where it's word for word identical. The first three examples are in all three, And so according to this theory, that was originally Mark material that Matthew and Luke used. Whereas this three here is only Matthew and Luke. It's not in Mark. And so that we just call the Q source. It presumably came from somewhere. So, but this is all very, very theoretical. For example, scholars fully admit that if there was a Q version of the gospel story or the teaching of Jesus, it's very likely that Q and Mark overlapped. Right? Extremely possible that there would be some of the same material in the Q source as there is in the Gospel of Mark, even if they're independent. They're both writing down the teaching of Jesus. So very likely they would overlap. And so it's possible that in some cases, Matthew and Luke, if you use this theory, let's go all the way back to the end. There we go. Back here. Go all the way back here. It's very possible that in some cases, Matthew and Luke, if they have both Q and Mark in front of them, it's possible that they had two slightly different versions of the same saying of Jesus. The one recorded by the Q author, the one recorded by Mark. And then they, had to kind of choose. There's so many unknowns here. So many unknowns. And redaction criticism says that they are theologians. And this is what we're going to get into, and we'll talk about in December. To what extent did they feel they had the right to slightly edit the words of Jesus? Was their goal basically to be a dictaphone and exactly record, I mean, like the video camera, preserve exactly? Or did they feel they had some right to edit a little bit the exact words of Jesus, paraphrase it in order to present slightly different theological points? Like I said, how Matthew brings in the word righteousness. And we're going to get into this more in December. In any case, the Oxford hypothesis is the theory that dominates both conservative and liberal scholars generally accept this. You'll notice here that we are, for the most part, we're talking about real manuscripts. I mean, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they exist. So it's not speculation in that sense. We have Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We can look at them word for word, and we can compare, and we have to deal with that. Q is hypothetical, but the Q content is actually exactly in Matthew and Luke. So the content here is all real. There's nothing speculative. Well, it is speculative, but it's based on real manuscripts, which is very different from what we saw with the documentary hypothesis, for example, where the JEDP versions of the Pentateuch, there are no manuscripts of them. It's much more theoretical, much more speculative. That is far more speculative. The Oxford hypothesis also does not in any way challenge what is written in the Bible. It doesn't deny anything or tell us to ignore anything in the Bible. Unlike the case with Isaiah, where the source critical theory of Isaiah does lead you into a direct theological conflict with the message of the text. With this theory, it doesn't. And that's why conservative scholars, I mean, not everyone agrees with it, but most do. It's not a problem. And so I generally will accept this. I won't say it's absolutely true. I will just say it seems to be the best explanation so far. Which means, now what does that mean? And this is the question, why is any of this important and should we care about this at all? Here there is something that can be useful when we're reading these Gospels. If we accept this, that Mark was first, and Mark then was the conscious source for Matthew and Luke. It means Matthew and Luke had Mark open in front of them. Okay? They had this text here. They saw this, they read this, and then the Holy Spirit inspired them to write their own gospel, where they start with this as the base, and then they tell more, not just tell more, as in different stories, more stories, but they also are presenting a slightly different picture of Jesus so that we can focus on a slightly different theological aspect, which is why God gave us four gospels. What does that mean for you when you're reading these? If you are reading a passage in Luke that is very, very similar to a passage in Mark, only with small differences, then you assume that Luke saw Mark. Luke had Mark, which means any differences, any changes, are Luke's intentional adapting of the story. So if the order of events changes, for example, or the exact wording changes, Luke is changing what he reads in Mark under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit for a theological purpose. What's the purpose? Why? Let me see if I can give an example here. Yeah, here. For example, very simple example, and I don't know if this one is very theological. Mark 15, verse 39. The death of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus, and there is the soldier who is witnessing all of this. And yeah, here we go. What does the soldier say? Matthew 15, verse, where was it? I just said it. What verse was it? Ms. Konken Uhexa, 39. The centurion, the Roman soldier, stood there. He's watching the crucifixion. He sees Jesus die. He says what? Truly this man was what? The Son of God. Okay. According to this theory, Luke, of course, was not there at the cross. But now Luke has this in front of him. Now turn over to Luke chapter 23 and look at verse 47. Okay, Luke has Mark, he's read Mark, but now Luke is writing his own version. And what do we read? Now the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God and said, what? What? This was a righteous man. Okay, according to this theory, Luke had Mark in front of him. He knew that in the Gospel of Mark, the centurion said, "This is the Son of God." But now Luke has, "This was a righteous man." He sees this, but he writes this. Why? There's a theological reason. There's a reason. It's not an accident. It's not just, well, it just is. There's a reason Luke did this. Redaction criticism says everything they do for a theological reason. And that I agree with that. The Holy Spirit inspired this for a reason. Now, is it possible that the centurion said both things? Yes. And it's possible that in one of Luke's other sources, both were written. Maybe the centurion said, "Surely this was the Son of God, a righteous man." But Mark only focused on the Son of God, and Luke saw Mark and said, "Okay, I'm going to say something different." You see, it's not necessarily a question of right and wrong. Not automatically. So you don't have to worry and jump right to that. You can ask the question, why did Luke choose to focus on the righteous man? I'm not going to try to answer that. I'm just using that as an example. That if you recognize which one came first, then you can look at them from that perspective. If Luke knew Mark, then why does Luke make these little changes? Look at the miracles of Jesus. Look at the parables of Jesus. Look at any of these that are told in both Gospels or in Matthew and Mark. And if this theory is correct, then Matthew, if the wording is a little bit different, he's doing something intentionally. He's intentionally adapting the wording to focus in a different direction, to paint a slightly different picture of Jesus, to preach a different sermon. He's preaching a different sermon about Jesus. And it helps us understand those differences. So there is something here that can be positive when you really get into the details of studying these Gospels. So this is not just an academic game. Or it's not just something that helps the translators and at that level. This is something that can actually be relevant for us when we read the Bible as well. Any last questions, comments about this? Have any of you, by any chance, just asking here, have any of you noticed when you've been reading the Gospels, have you noticed these kind of small differences in a way that has maybe caused problem or in a way that you saw something interesting and in a way that you thought, okay, that those differences are maybe complementary and maybe helpful? The second, the complimentary and helpful, do you remember exactly? And so when you read them in parallel, then you see that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think now when you read them in parallel, yeah, I hope so. That's the point.
Aga mis siis saab, kui oletunud näiteks siis, ma ei tea, Luukas on siis päriselt sündinud juhtmust veits muutnud, et seda nagu sobitada tema dialoogilise nagu mõttega või sellega, mida tahab edasi öelda, et ta muutud nii-öelda siis tõde, et nagu mis siis nagu teha või mis siis saab.
Okay, I think translator got confused. Okay, what happens? Oh, it still thinks you're the teacher now. Hello, don't let Hanna be the teacher or Kadre. Okay, I have to stand right in front of Kadre so that Kadre disappears from the camera. There we go. Okay, now follow me. No, okay, we're going to have to go to the old-fashioned method. Okay, the question was, basically, your question is, where is the line between the different gospel authors adapting or selecting what to record, and where does it become cross the line where it becomes creating fiction and changing the truth of what happened or what was said? And you're not, that's what you're worried about.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. That is a very understandable and a very, very, very understandable and a very real concern. I don't want to deny that. And maybe, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because that is a very real concern. And we're going to actually go on to this next time because we're going to talk specifically about Jesus and exactly actually this question. And what I will say right now is kind of what I said earlier, whether it is in the Gospels or in the books of Kings or in the book of Exodus, I do not believe that their primary goal was to give us a video recording of events. For example, if you remember, in Old Testament survey, I use this example that if you read the story of Abraham, Abraham dies. And then in the next chapter, Jacob and Esau are born. So Jacob and Esau are born after Abraham dies. It's the next chapter. But if you read carefully, it says how old Abraham was when he died. It says how old he was when Isaac was born and how old Isaac was when Jacob and Esau were born. So you can do the math, follow the ages, and you find out that actually Jacob and Esau were 15 years old when their grandfather Abraham died. But the author of Genesis is telling the story, not with a video camera, exactly second by second, day by day, exact order. He's telling the story. And he finishes the story of Abraham. Abraham dies and he is buried. And then he starts the story of Jacob and Esau. Is that a mistake? Is it a lie? Is it breaking what is true? No. It is simply that the storyteller is telling the story the way he decides to tell the story. And the fact is, we all do that. And the way we tell the story of what happened to us, something happened to you in summer, or you gave a testimony yesterday about your family going back and you gave exact dates and years and you have a very good memory. But the way you tell that story, the way you told the story yesterday might be different from the way you tell the story next year to a different audience. Because you maybe want to use the same testimony, but you're talking to different people and you want to kind of move them in a different, slightly different direction. It's not necessarily a question of right and wrong. It's a question of the way you're telling the story in order to communicate the message. As I said, the authors of the Bible, they're all theologians. They are all, their primary goal is to communicate a spiritual message. And as I said, from the very beginning of church history, they recognize that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are painting slightly different pictures of Jesus. Because God wants us to see different sides, to see more. If we only had one gospel, we would only have one picture of Jesus. Now we have four. So ours, and this is where, again, our culture is so much influenced by the Enlightenment, by rational scientific search for truth. Our first question is, what is true and what is false? What really happened? Whereas for the Bible authors, the most important question is the spiritual theological message. At the same time, already in the Old Testament with the Jewish, the Israelite theology, it was very much connected to the history. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. I did this in your history, therefore you obey me now. And that theme goes all the way through the prophets, that the history of what God did is the foundation for why we trust God. So the history is important. But the exact details of how the story is told, like I said, and this is maybe for you, Hannah, maybe this would be a very good assignment then, if you do the research paper assignment on comparing Hezekiah and the time from Hezekiah to Joash in Kings compared to the way it is in Chronicles. Don't look at the historical question of what happened, but look at the theological message that these two books are presenting. And I think that's what really is most important. So I'm not, your question is very real, and it's serious for me too. I don't want to say that, well, someone is making things up, it's fiction. But there is a line between saying something is complete fiction and then saying that something is an exact minute-by-minute video recorded, chronological, exact, true account. The reality is actually a spectrum. Every time you tell a story of what happened in your life, you're not giving a video camera recording. You're adapting, retelling, paraphrasing what the people said. But yeah, we're going to actually get into this. This is exactly what we'll deal with in December. And this is where it gets very, very important, is about Jesus. Do we know what he actually said, what he did? And how do we deal with the differences that do exist? So the soldier at the cross in one gospel says one thing, in another gospel says something else. Indrek, you mentioned yesterday, or was it today? When was it? That if you look carefully at when Peter betrays Jesus and when the rooster crows, what was it you said? The rooster crows nine times? Yeah, because the little details are different. And so there is a question, does the rooster crow nine times, or is it just told in different ways so that it makes it look like it's different, but maybe it's actually the same thing just told in a different way? It's all actually very complicated. But ultimately, when the question, do we go to heaven when we die, does not depend upon how many times the rooster crowed, or our understanding of how many times the rooster crowed. The theological message behind it is what matters.